Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. In the summer of 1873, a vicar in Lincolnshire, the Reverend Frank Besant, issued an ultimatum to his wife. She must either take Holy Communion regularly at his church or leave him. His wife, who had begun to doubt her Christian faith, later wrote, "Hypocrisy or expulsion? I chose the latter." The woman's name was Annie Besant, and she went on to become one of the most prominent social reformers of the late 19th century. The causes she fought for included not only secularism and women's rights, but also freedom of speech, socialism, Irish home rule, and better conditions for workers. She spearheaded the celebrated strike by match girls at the Bryant and May factory in Bow, East London, in 1888, and was put on trial for obscenity for daring to publish a pamphlet on birth control. About midway through life, she became a theosophist and moved to India, establishing herself as a leading figure in the nationalist movement there and being appointed the first woman president of the Indian National Congress in 1917. With me to discuss the life and work of Annie Besant are Lawrence Goldman, Fellow in Modern History at St. Peter's College, University of Oxford, David Stack, Reader in History at the University of Reading, and Yasmin Khan, Senior Lecturer in Politics and International Relations at Royal Holloway, University of London. Lawrence Goldman, Annie Besant, who was born Annie Wood in 1847 in London. Can you give us some idea of her family?
Yes, her parents, in fact, were Irish. Her father was William Wood. Her mother was Ellen Morris. They'd met in Dublin and married there. They came over in 1845 to London at the time of the famine. And her father, in fact, was an underwriter working in the City of London. Wood, William Wood, was actually from a very notable family, and Annie had very notable relations. One of her Wood relations had been the Lord Mayor of London, an MP, a successful merchant. Another of her relations, William Page Wood, became Lord Chancellor in Gladstone's first administration as Baron Hatherley, a notable liberal reforming Lord Chancellor. She even had another Wood relation, Kitty Catherine Wood, who was very notable as the second wife of Charles Stuart Parnell, the Irish nationalist, and the cause of some scandal when there were divorce proceedings from her first husband. So she came from a talented family background. Many of the Woods had reached positions of note in British society, and I think that showed really in the way she formed her own life.
But then her father died of TB when she was five, and her mother decided, instead of taking charity, to take over a boys' boarding house up in Harrow, at the Harrow School, and this was deemed unsuitable for Annie, so she was, as it were, farmed out to this woman, Ellen Marriott in Dorset, sister of the famous writer, a wealthy woman who herself educated Annie until the age of 16.
Absolutely. Farmed out sounds a bit tough, actually, but in fact, I mean, it was probably the best thing that happened to Annie. Ellen Marriott was a spinster. As you say, she was the sister of a famous boys' author. Captain Marriott had been a Royal Naval officer in the Napoleonic Wars and then wrote some children's literature, very famous children's literature in the Victorian period. His sister was a notable woman herself, well-educated, and she took in young girls, like Annie and others, to educate them from respectable families. So Annie went down to Charmouth in Dorset, leaving Harrow, and for the next 6 or 7 years down there, she was a pupil of Ellen Marriott, and she had a very fine education, Latin, modern languages, history, geography, and she was taught, as it were, to research for herself. She was taught to be curious. She became a fine stylist in English, of course. Her languages were perfected through trips to Germany and to Paris. And by 16, Ellen Marriott had to report that there was nothing more that she could actually teach this young lady. And she came back to Harrow at that point.
There was another example that this lady offered her, which was of philanthropy and helping people.
Oh, absolutely. Miss Marriott was a strict evangelical. There wasn't much reading of novels and plays for divertissement in her academy, as it were. But she had a very strong social conscience, and she taught her girls to care for the poor locally, in the area, and so forth. And this was another of those themes that you find early on in Annie's life.
Just extraordinary how well-educated she was by 16, after only 7 years there. But David Stack, can you talk a bit about her Annie Besant's religion, which Annie Wood, as she was at that stage, but still, let's call her Annie Besant, it's a lot easier. And because it was a big factor throughout her life, for, against, indifferent. What was her religion when she left Miss Marryat's school?
I think the first thing to say is when she leaves Miss Marryat's school at the age of 16 and a half, given what comes afterwards, the important thing to note is that she's completely unaware of the world of politics, and she is, as you say, deeply religious. And until the Easter of 1866, really, when she meets her husband, Frank Besant, she...
Can I just talk... Can you tell us what religion... Yeah. There were so many different...
No, I was coming to that, yeah.
Right, fine.
No,
okay.
I mean, her life is one of pleasant contentment. The religion she imbibes from Marryat is an evangelical devotion to truth and duty, which become the defining features of her life throughout. What she doesn't take from Marryat is that she becomes interested in aspects of Catholicism, particularly during a trip to Paris with Marryat. She is, as she puts it herself, made of the very stuff that fanatics are made of at this stage. She has imbibed this evangelical notion.
She put it herself in her autobiography.
In her autobiography, yes, later on in her life. But by 1866, 1867, two things are happening in Besant's life. Firstly, she has the first notions of doubt come upon her. In the Easter of 1866, she is following the Gospels through the Easter period. And this leads her to do something which is quite characteristic of Victorians interested in religious matters, which is to sit down and compare and contrast four Gospels. Now, at this point, she finds inconsistencies, but she's reconciled to them. But a seed of religious doubt has been sown quite early on. The second thing which happens in this period is in 1867, when she's staying with William Roberts, who's a family friend in Manchester. And this dear old man, as she calls him, is her first tutor in radicalism. She's staying with Roberts in 1867 at the time of the famous smashing of the van incident, in which two Fenian prisoners are taken out of a prison van and a police constable killed. And then five members of the Irish Republican Brotherhood are put on trial, and three of them are hanged outside Salford Jail. And this has a deep effect upon Besant, too. His background is Irish, and although her own upbringing is very English, identifies herself with the Irish cause.
And nevertheless, having had that radical taste of radicalism, which obviously a taste is much to her taste,
yes,
she marries a strict clergyman, one assumes, on the advice of her mother, someone she met in Clapham, and she's only 20, he's about 25, 26, something. And
I think he's 7 years older than her.
Like that. Yeah. So what happens there?
Well, they meet at Easter 1866, at this time when she's having the first doubts. They meet, as you say, in the Clapham Mission Church, where Frank Besant, the son of a wine merchant just down from Cambridge, is the new deacon, and Annie and an aunt go to arrange flowers. They then spend some time together when a group from the church go on a holiday, and having spent time together, she's startled to find that Frank proposes to her. And she's slightly offended by this as well, because if she thinks it implies that she's been flirting. And then they drift, as she puts it, into an engagement, or she drifts into engagement with a man that she makes no pretense to love.
And they marry, nevertheless?
They marry, yes.
Cut to the chase here, because I've got a lot to talk about her life. They marry, and they have two children. She seems to be disillusioned with him from very early on. And then there's this case of principle he brings up. He goes to Lincolnshire. If she's going to stay with him, she has to take Holy Communion, and she refuses. That must have been quite a thing.
Well, a case of principle, except a year later she does take Holy Communion with her mother when her mother's on her deathbed.
But not for him.
But not for him, no. What Annie says about the marriage is that they were unsuitable from the start. She says they were an ill-matched pair and should never have been married for a number of reasons. One, that he is very much of the master in his own house, in theory, and she has this sense of independence which she's learned from Marryat. He also treats her harshly, possibly violently, and she's never been treated harshly either by Miss Marryat or by her mother, and so she responds initially with incredulity and then with defiance. She also marries, it must be said, in perfect innocence, as she puts it, of the marriage relation. She says she knows no more about the marriage relation than if she'd been aged 4 rather than aged 20. And the other factor, as you say, building on this, is this loss of faith which she experiences. Part of the reason that she ends up marrying Frank Besant is because of her deep religiosity, which leads her to identify her devotion, her sense of romance, her sublimated sexuality, perhaps, is all concentrated on the figure of Christ. And as a later associate of hers puts it, and she was unable to be bride of heaven, so she ended up being the bride of Frank Besant, and he was far from an adequate substitute.
But she's already worried about Christ because she's met this chap Voysey, who has said that Christ is not divine, there are no miracles, he is a spiritual man, and she takes that on board almost completely and writes her own pamphlet about it, saying these things.
She does. I mean, there's a she does that. In 1872, she writes a pamphlet of questioning the divinity of Christ. But there's also a personal incident involved in this as well. I mean, partly there's the breakdown of relations with Frank, but there's also the illness of her daughter Mabel in 1871, who suffers a severe bout of whooping cough, and it looks like she's on the point of death for a long time. And Annie comes out of this really questioning her religious commitment, questioning the notion of how you can reconcile evil in the universe with a good and loving God, and questioning notions of eternal damnation, atonement, revelation, your fundamental building blocks of Christianity.
Another Yasmin Khan, she's met William Roberts, radical, and been influenced by him. She's encountered Voysey and she's influenced by him. The next person, after she's left her husband, she comes to London and with one of the children, the other, he keeps the boy, she takes the girl. She meets Charles Bradlaugh, president of the National Secular Society. And can you tell us a bit about him and why and how he influenced her?
Charles Bradlaugh is enormously important to Annie Besant. He's perhaps the most important relationship that she has in her life. He's a mentor, a friend, an ally over the next 20 years until his death. She comes to London and she's in really rather a precarious situation now. She's left her husband, she's maintaining a household, her mother is sick and dying, and she's taking shelter in the British Museum reading room. And one day on a bus on the way to Victoria, she picks up a copy of a newspaper, the National Reformer, which is Charles Bradlaugh's newspaper, which promotes atheism. And she is struck by the newspaper, by what she reads, and she arranges a meeting with Bradlaugh. She goes and sees him, and he instantly recognises her talents as a speaker, as a publicist, and is the most influential person in turning Annie Besant away perhaps from the scepticism about religion to fully fledged atheism and free thought, which at the time is very, very scandalous. He is feared throughout Britain to some extent. And he's already famous for being the most prominent atheist in British society at that time. So by linking together with Bradlaugh, she has a whole new platform for disseminating ideas.
We must tell listeners that he was elected MP for Northampton four times, but not allowed to take his seat because he refused to swear the oath. The Northampton people stuck to him, but he refused to swear the oath. He wanted to affirm it, and they wouldn't let him affirm it. That didn't come in until 20 years later. So that itself was a huge scandal.
But he's a remarkable person because he's self-educated almost from the age of 12. He grew up in the East End of London, the son of a clerk at a dock workers, and he is so committed to his cause that even though he would love to take his seat as an MP, he sticks to this position. And that actually generates a lot of popularity for him among working class population of Northampton who stick to him over those years. And he does eventually take his seat as an MP.
So he took her under his wing, and there were rumours about this, that and the other, but let's just talk about the way he mentored her as a public speaker and as a writer, for instance. She became an extremely effective public speaker.
Yes. One of the telling anecdotes in Annie Besant's autobiography is she says back when she was in the parish in Sibsey in Lincolnshire and still married, she took to the pulpit of the church when it was empty and practised public speaking. And she mentions how she was struck by the power and delight of her voice. And I think this says a lot about her because really she builds a following through her abilities in public speaking. And of course, at this time, there's no radio, there's no other media that can work as effectively as the lecture hall, and lectures get notices, they get reviews, so she becomes a famous public speaker. Beatrice Webb says, for instance, that she has the voice of a beautiful soul, and she's able to convey her cause very effectively, and Bradlaugh mentors her in that as well, of course.
What cause, what is she speaking about?
Well, she's speaking about the fact that the Christian church is power in the state, the fact that she doesn't believe that God exists, and that other religions are all spurious sort of state created.
So she's basically putting the National Secularist Society
case. She's putting the National Secularist Society's case. But the National Secularist Society is also connected to a whole network of other radical movements who are interested in other issues. And there's a scene in London which she's part of. So they link up with other criticisms of policies around the world, including Irish interests, and Home Rule for Ireland, of course, becomes a big cause, including criticism of imperial actions by Britain overseas. So it's a world where, for her, atheism is central, but these other causes are connected to it.
It could be said that in one way, the Irish, her Irishness, which she was very proud of, and her interest in convictions about Irish politics, was part of the making of her as well.
Absolutely. She's very proud of being Irish. She says her blood is three quarters Irish, but her heart is 100% Irish. And she has almost a romantic vision of Ireland. She didn't actually go there until later in life, but she sees it as a place where real justice can occur, and a cause that she's obliged to fight for within Britain. And of course, much later on, when she gets involved in Indian politics, there's a lot of parallels between Irish Home Rule and the Indian Home Rule that she begins to demand.
Yes, you could interchange the phrases she uses between Ireland and India. Ronce Goldman has been referred to, although she's in the National Secular Society, there are a lot of these organisations interconnect with their cousinships and brotherhoods, as it were, with other societies. Can you give us some idea of the way this reforming movements were going in the last third of the 19th century?
Yes, well, in the 1870s, when she comes to London and makes contact with secularists and atheists, one needs to note that these are not yet socialists. She will become later on in the 1880s a socialist herself and associate with socialists. But these tend to be radical individualists, often radical liberals in their politics, concerned about matters of church and state, often rather more than they're concerned about social equity, class struggle and so forth. That's to be, if you like, a later phase in her career. To understand secularism, you have to understand a kind of spectrum, really. There are people who are just beginning to doubt Christian revelation. They're beginning to doubt aspects of Christian orthodoxy, like, for example, the Reverend Charles Voysey, who's one of her first contacts in London, who's been deprived of his parish because he simply doesn't believe in it any longer in central Christian doctrine. But there's also, at the other end of the spectrum, people like Bradlaugh and even more militant figures who are militant atheists and materialists who reject the whole idea of a deity and a spiritual world. And she, as it were, comes to rest at several different points. She knows many of the key figures in London, but it's not...
Such as?
Well, for example, she meets Moncure Daniel Conway, a notable American who comes to Britain during the Civil War. He's a minister in Virginia. He comes to London. He becomes the voice, really, of the South Place Chapel and the founder of the South Place Ethical Societies. And ethical societies spring up over London and in other places as well, where people who we might call vaguely humanist come together. And what they're doing, if you like, is transferring their allegiance from God to man. Often these are people very interested in social reform. And as Beatrice Webb once put it, I mean, what characterises this age is the transference of the kind of relationship that people hitherto had with the deity to their relationship with their fellow men and women.
David Stack, she came to even more prominence. It's quite interesting to see this woman coming out of this little school in Dorset, almost a sort of development of a dame school, really, and then suddenly being in secular pulpits all around the country. We just have to take, obviously, for granted, because obviously she gained enormous reputation, but it takes some thinking about. But she and Bradlaugh, and Yasmin's explained how close they were together for how long, became involved in a public debate about birth control,
yes,
which got them into a lot of trouble with the state. Can you tell us something about that?
In a sense, it's a public debate about freedom of information and liberty as much as it is about birth control, because it comes about because of a prosecution under the Obscene Publications Act of two publishers for publishing a leaflet a pamphlet, Charles Knowlton's The Fruits of Philosophy, promoting the birth control cause. Birth control propaganda had continued more or less unchallenged for around 50 years up until the mid-1870s. The first attempts at birth control propaganda in Britain occurred in the 1820s. Firstly,
when you say birth control propaganda, you mean propaganda for birth control?
Propaganda for birth control, yes. Yeah, the whole debate about population changes its nature at the end of the 18th century when Thomas Robert Malthus writes his essay on the principle of population. And from that moment on, the notion that there might be a need to restrain population growth takes off. Malthus himself stops at the notion of moral restraint, the idea that people marry late and are strictly moral up until the point at which they marry, but others are not so shy. And so in the 1820s, a number of radicals, such as Francis Place, the radical tailor of Charing Cross, and more pertinently for us, I think, Richard Carlyle, begin to put out pamphlets arguing the case for birth control. And Carlyle is particularly interesting because his pamphlet, What is Love, which he publishes in 1826, makes a radical case for birth control, which also embraces elements of notions of free love, female sexual pleasure, and an attack on the church. And there's a direct connection here with Bradlaugh and Besant, because as a young man, Bradlaugh lodges with Carlyle's widow, Eliza Sharples, and also falls in love with Carlyle's eldest daughter, Hypatia. And Bradlaugh is interested in birth control thereafter. In 1861, he attempts to found a Malthusian League, but it's very difficult to drum up any interest at
this
point.
Can we go back to Bradlaugh and Besant, then, what they did?
So what happens is, in the winter of 1876-1877, two publishers, firstly Henry Cook in Bristol, and Wren, the publisher of most of Bradlaugh's publications, in London, are charged under the Obscene Publications Act with publishing Charles Knowlton's Fruits of Philosophy, another one of these pamphlets advocating birth control. And this is the first time that the state have used the law to try to limit the spread of knowledge about birth control.
And so where do Bradlaugh and Besant come into it?
Well, at this point, when Charles Watts, their publisher, pleads guilty, Cook has been sentenced to 2 years hard labour. Yeah. So when their publisher pleads guilty, they think at this point where they want this kind of information to circulate and that this is really an attack on the secular movement. So what Bradlaugh and Besant do is they form the Freethought Publishing Company, print another copy of Charles Knowlton's pamphlet, march down to the chief clerk at the Guildhall, put it in front of him and say, this is what we're going to publish, please arrest us.
And?
They're arrested and they're charged with publishing a certain lewd, bawdy and obscene publication in March 1877.
And then can you just take us through? They're arrested and they're tried?
They're tried in June 1877. And one thing that's worth saying is that in the interim, sales of Charles Knowlton's Fruits of Philosophy take off. It's estimated by one historian, and figures are very difficult, of course, to estimate, but it's estimated by one historian that 125,000 copies of his pamphlet.
So what happens when they're arrested? After they're arrested and tried, then what?
They're arrested, they're tried. The trial itself, which lasts 4 days, is a major public event. It throws up problems of propriety. The Times reports this as the Queen versus Bradlaugh and another, because they don't want to put Besant's name in as a woman. Besant and Bradlaugh defend themselves. Bradlaugh's case is based around the notion of liberty and freedom of information. Besant's case is based around poverty and the need to end poverty through restricting the number of births.
As I understand it, the court fines against them, but they don't go to prison.
The verdict which the jury brings in is not simply a guilty or not guilty. They find that the publication is indecent and obscene under the terms of the Act, but they say that Bradlaugh and Besant have no impure motives. The judge interprets this as a guilty verdict.
Can I go to you then, Yasmin? What effect did this have on Annie Besant in her life and in her views, given that this was, as David said, this was a real push to the forefront of the news, the national news? She was the national news for a while. With Bradlaugh, of course.
Personally, at first, there's a sense of elation because they have managed to put this on the front page of the newspapers. They haven't gone to prison, as many of their friends warned. She was warned off this by many, many people who were otherwise sympathetic to her because they said, look, you're going to put your name in such disrepute. You're going to be a woman, a marked woman. But she manages to pull it off. She defends herself extremely well in the court case and is articulates all her reasons for being in favour of birth control. So all those ways, it's a success. However, personally for her afterwards, there's a tragedy, because up until this point, her young daughter, Mabel, has been living with her. Child custody arrangements in the case of separation had been altered slightly by this time, and a woman could take custody of a young child. But Frank Sibsey, sitting up in Frank, her husband Besant, sitting up in Sibsey, the parish in Lincolnshire, is not pleased to have his name being brought into disrepute in this way, and Annie Besant all over the newspapers. And he sees this as his time to take some revenge for the shame that she's brought upon him. And he goes about trying to take back custody of Mabel, the young daughter who's only 7 years old, and he's successful in that. He wins his case on the grounds that Annie Besant has been removing Mabel from religious education at school, and on the grounds that she's giving the young girl atheistic treatment, and after that she's removed, and Annie Besant doesn't live with her child again until she's 17 years old. And in the interim, Mabel is sent to a boarding school and back to the parish, and has a rather miserable childhood. So it personally, that sends Besant into what could now be described as a nervous breakdown. She's thoroughly depressed, and so it's a very mixed outcome from the Knowlton trial.
But one thing, Lawrence Goldman, is that she moves increasingly drawn into socialism, which at that time was not in certain areas all that far removed from religion. I mean, a little later, Keir Hardie said, I learned more from Jesus of Nazareth than from any socialist writings and so on. Mm. So she's still holding on to that, because it's important when it comes to theosophy. She's not letting it, but she's moving into socialism. And Darwinism has come in. Sorry to throw all this at you, but
yes.
There you go.
Well, I think
can you just take us into that? I mean, yes. I'm trying to head for Bloody Sunday.
Right, OK. Well, I mean, I think we can capture this in a phrase that historians use, the religion of early socialism. And if for many people who turned to socialism in what's known as the socialist revival in the 1880s, the foundations of the Fabian Society, the Social Democratic Federation in London, which is the first Marxist organisation, and a range of other organisations from the early 1880s, for many people who come into socialism, actually it is a kind of surrogate for religion. Many are nonconformists, many are moving away from their churches, many are looking for a new kind of brotherhood to take the place of religious fervour and religious belief. And in many ways, what happens after the trial in regard to birth control is a natural movement into socialism. This is where many of those kind of secularists are moving in the 1880s, and she follows that path.
But she doesn't only follow it. Yet again, as with birth control, she goes to the front of it. I mean, she is leading with George Bernard Shaw, one of the four columns, marching on Trafalgar Square. Mm. A lot of radicals are going to meet there, but the state, the country, says no and won't let them in. Mm. And there's a violent clash. Three people are killed. Bloody Sunday, she's there. Mm. They won't arrest her, although she wants to be arrested.
She wants to be arrested, that's right. I mean, Bloody Sunday is the sort of great set piece of the 1880s. It's the great set piece in the capital between socialists and radicals and the forces of establishment and order, and it links together so many of the issues that Besant has held as her own. Ostensibly, it's about coercion in Ireland, government policies reducing civil liberties in Ireland, and of course, as we've said, that's one of the crucial things in her makeup. It's also about economic deprivation and class conflict in the capital, which has grown across the 1880s. Poverty has been, if you like, rediscovered in the capital, and there have been riots in 1886 in Clubland and the West End of the unemployed. And Bloody Sunday becomes also a crucial moment over public space, over Trafalgar Square and the right to demonstrate. Many of these radical and socialist groups want to have the right to go to Trafalgar Square and make their pitch, and in a way that's very contemporary, because our own society has this problem today as well. Law and order dictates a rather different kind of approach, and there's great concern that the radicalism might get out of control.
Can we go from that to the Bryanton May, the Match Girls strike in 1888? The Match Girls, about 1,400 of them in Bow, in a factory run, sadly, as it turns out, by Quakers, sadly, because we get, I mean, they're such. Anyway, they run the Bryanton May. These girls, by the age of 15, they're getting Fossey Jaw, which is a terrible, incurable disease. Their wages are dreadful. And there's a strike. They decide to strike, and they call her in to help them, and she becomes associated with Arturo Rajput. We've got a lot to get through. What was its significance, and what was her significance in the strike?
Her significance was to link it to the wider public realm, because she has journalist friends. W.T. Stead, for instance, can put it on the front page of the Pall Mall Gazette, and she's able to publicise the strike. And that brings pressure to bear on the Bryant and May factory, who concede some of the demands of the girls, in particular not docking their pay for small misdemeanours or small petty issues, like arriving a few seconds late for work. So in that sense, Annie Besant is able to publicise the strike. She's able to give it a public face. And
she writes about it, white slavery.
She describes it as white slavery. And it's the first unorganised workers' strike that comes to prominence that is successful. So in that sense, it has a defining moment in the history of workers' rights. And that's the outcome of Besant's lobbying, and also the network of people that she's able to mobilise around the strike. I think for the girls themselves, it can be overestimated. I mean, they phosphorus wasn't taken out of use until the early 20th century, so the fossil jaw remains, and their wages didn't actually increase. So it was, in terms of the actual concessions that were made, they were minimal. But the point was that unorganised labour could collectively act, and that they were young women. They were just able to win that cause.
Arguably, one of the solid things she did was when she was elected to the London School Board, and did a lot in that, because she's right in the thick of things now, isn't she, in London. She's a big figure, she's active, she's working, she's got allies all over the place. But, David Stack, in the end of the 1880s, her most radical change is she became very interested in theosophy.
Yeah.
And she seems to make an about turn on most other things because of this attraction to theosophy. Can you tell us what it was and why she embraced it so firmly?
Well, in Besant's own terms, she doesn't make an about turn. She sees it as the culmination of her life and her various
stages. Well, she doesn't, if I may say so. I mean, she repudiates the birth control. She says, because theosophy says that you can't have reincarnation and birth control. So that's one of the big things.
She withdraws the pamphlet, The Law of Population, 1891, at the recommendation of Madame Blatowski. But her whole autobiography, published 2 years later, is an attempt to show how her life has been a journey towards theosophy, and how each of the beliefs she's held before that have represented staging posts in that movement. Theosophy itself is derived from the two Greek words theos and sophia, and means divine wisdom. The Theosophical Society that Besant joined has been formed in 1875 in New York by Madame Blatowski and Colonel Olcott. But its roots, I suppose, or its spirit in every sense, is Eastern religion. Theosophy is the belief that there is a brotherhood known as the White Lodge, or the Hierarchy of Adepts, which watch over the evolution of humanity, and that these adepts have evolved to a higher level and achieved power over nature, so that they can appear as apparitions, they can make writing appear on pieces of paper locked in the study drawers of Victorian men and women. It's all wrapped up in elements of Buddhism, with notions of karma, reincarnation, and the idea that the universe exists on multiple planes, physical, mental, astral, and nirvanic. And so it's a marrying of the Western esoteric tradition with various elements of Eastern religion.
But she embraced it very fiercely, Yasmin Khan, and she moved to India, which was its sort of, what do you call it, sort of epicentre, was in India in 1893, about halfway through her life, and was more associated with India from then on.
Absolutely.
I still can't quite see why she did move out of the country. Maybe she didn't turn her back on things, but she did move out of the country. Why she was so entranced by it?
I think it's consistent with Annie Besant's constant questing towards a universal answer to the condition of human life, and the her need to find a transcendent way of understanding human suffering. And I think that is actually consistent with her searches in Christianity and then in atheism. And I think theosophy for her answers some of the bigger problems, the root causes of human suffering, and does it in a way that doesn't mean that she has to exclude any other group. And she can all people can be part of theosophy, all different religions are equal within theosophy. And so in that sense, I think it has a very strong appeal to her. India also has an appeal because it's the place that she can build a new base. By 1891, Bradlow has passed away. Madame Blavatsky, her mentor in the theosophical movement, has died. And Annie Besant, it's a logical next step for her to go to India. She's already been interested in India, and the theosophists in London had already been connected to Indian students. For instance, Gandhi, as a young student, had already met Besant and had been on the fringes of the Theosophical Society in London. So there were connections between London and India established already. And she goes in 1893, and she doesn't really come back, although she does visit and come back for the hot summers, sensibly. She stays in India and builds her base there in Benares, in the holy Hindu city of Benares, and initially works in educational movements and in cultural movements, and doesn't really step into frontline politics again until the First World War. But in that educational movements, what she's concerned with doing is revitalizing Hinduism and in championing cultural causes. So she sets up a school in Benares, which is about reviving Sanskrit education. She learns Sanskrit and she carries out translations, and it's involved in cultural and educational activities.
In that sense, of course, David Stack was right, and I was wrong to go too far in that she was doing with that school in Benares what she'd been doing in London with the London School Board, was to get children into school. And she was doing in India what she'd done from near the beginning of her life. She saw India as another island, and worked for Indian independence. And even in the First World War, you know, she was England's need is India's opportunity. Mm-hmm. Go against them, and was imprisoned, interred for a while there. So she took her political views to India. Can you just tell us a bit more about India, Lawrence?
Well, there, you know, there are a group of theosophists who come together. She's not alone in any way. And they've come from different places, Australia, America. They form a kind of a base, an estate that they take at Adyar outside Madras. And that becomes the theosophists' kind of a kind of heartland there. And they're engaged not only in their own self-questing for spiritual sustenance, but of course in good works as well locally in India. And then comes a sort of crucial moment in Besant's life when a young boy is, as it were, located and is... It's decided almost by the movement that this boy, who's 9 years old when he's first kind of discovered and found, this boy, whose name is Jiddu Krishnamurti, he will be the world teacher. He will spread the message of the theosophists. He will go out almost prophet-like and be one of the great figures, as it were, to link together all the cultures in peace and harmony. And Krishnamurti becomes central to her. She becomes his legal guardian. She becomes the legal guardian to him and his brother. She comes back to England with him and she tries to educate him in a Western way. He goes to Paris, he learns French. He's, as it were, set up to be the great prophet of the movement.
But apart from that, and that doesn't end well because he declines to be the great prophet.
Yeah, indeed.
Rather than that, David Sack, she gets involved in politics. She goes around, as I understand, making great speeches, and she ends up as the first woman president of the Indian National Congress. So she's out there in the field working away there. Can you give us some colouring to that?
I think probably Lawrence is in a better
position.
Well,
I'm going to turn to Yasmin, the Indian historian.
As long as you don't keep passing it around the table. As long as the parcel doesn't reach me, that's fine.
I think Annie Besant, it's fair to say, during the First World War, becomes one of the most prominent Indian independence leaders, or Indian Home Rule leaders, and for a time is at the forefront of campaigns for Home Rule from Indian from imperial control in India. She sets up Home Rule Leagues, and what's interesting, she uses lots of the techniques that she's used in Victorian London and applies them in India. So you have these speaker tours, the lecture tours, the plant pamphleteering, the journalism, and the reading groups. And she mobilises a lot of educated, young, often Brahmin men, boys, to come into this Home Rule movement, which is takes the government somewhat by surprise. The government in India is in a vulnerable position in the First World War. They're sending soldiers across to Gallipoli and into the Western Front. And this mass movement is peaceful, and they don't quite know what to do with it because it's constitutional. And so she is very cleverly positioning herself as a mass political leader in India, and takes up that mantle and is elected president of the Indian National Congress in 1917. Which is the high point in her Indian political career, and really opens the door for Gandhi to come along a couple of years later and take forward that movement. So she's a pivotal person in the transformation of the Indian National Congress from a gentleman's club to a mass movement that involves ordinary Indians on the street, if you like.
Briskly, I'm afraid, how would you place her? What influence did she have, David Sachs?
She wasn't a particularly original intellectual in her writings. She was dutiful, committed, and fanatical about the various causes she embraced. She's also, I think, we need to remember, ineffably Victorian, particularly in her religiosity, and I'd include in her religiosity her atheism. It's very tempting to go for psychological explanations of Besant, to say that there was this martyrdom complex, this desire to follow charismatic leaders, usually male, who she met over time. But I think we ought to understand her within the context of Victorian society. In her autobiography, she talks about her life being an average one, which on one level is absurd. But equally, the causes she becomes involved with, secularism, the crisis of faith, birth control, socialism and spiritualism, these are some of the defining intellectual movements of the late 19th century. And so we can use her as a means to understand that period, I think.
And then there's India. Thank you very much, David Stack, Lawrence Goldman and Yasmin Khan. Next week we'll be talking about Al-Kindi in 9th century Baghdad, known as the philosopher of the Arabs. Thanks for listening.
If you've enjoyed this BBC podcast, why not try others such as The Forum, the discussion programme about global ideas. To find out more, visit bbcworldservice.com/forum.